Okay, so welcome to the last lecture on multiculturalism in Britain. And today I'm going to finish off a very brief history of West Indian immigration to Britain, and then go on to something which is even more important, which is the history of racism and anti-racism in Britain. I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear that it is a history with lots of ups and downs, and it's absolutely not some sort of smooth, automatic progress, because history doesn't work like that. I left you with the arrival of the Windrush in 1948, ship which came from the West Indies to bring workers to London, and there were lots of jobs. There were lots of jobs then, in the hospitals, on the buses in particular. In the hospitals, on the buses, because it turned out that public services, which are big bureaucratic machines, were less racist than small private companies, which depend on the individual prejudices of the small businessman. And so, in general, it was much easier to get a job in the public sector. Not necessarily a very good job. In fact, usually not a very good job, but it was easier. And you can see here they are. They've come from Jamaica, I think, and they're ready to go. They're all wearing a tie. This is 1948. Yeah, you must wear a tie. You know, how many people are wearing a tie here? Nope, not even the teacher isn't wearing a tie. It's shocking. And, of course, their idea is to come to Britain to make some money and go back to Jamaica 10 years later. And, of course, very often, as in all, that's not so easy to do. When they came to London, they expected London to be much nicer than it was. In school in Jamaica, you learned about how wonderful England was. You know, it was the history city. It was the English equivalent of Nous Ancêtres les Gaulois. Yeah, and so arriving in Britain, certainly they were very surprised and very unpleasantly surprised to find the racism on everyday things. You know, just signs in the window saying "No blacks here, please," or not even "please." Yeah, and this was something that hadn't been expected. And there we have the list of the Windrush passengers. Now, the Windrush was just the first ship, but it's become very symbolic. And today there are streets in London named after Windrush, Windrush Street. And in fact, in every 10 years or the anniversary of Windrush is celebrated by the West Indian community in London, and it's become quite a symbol of that. The next episode here, much later in the 1970s, mostly the children of the West Indian immigrants of the 50s were more involved in demanding rights. Now, of course, most people did not join any organisation at all. But in the 1960s, of course, in the United States, there was a huge black movement, and in Britain there was a small black movement, but along the same lines. And this is one example of it. This is a statement by the Universal Coloured People's Association. Black power in Britain. There you can see the picture of what's the animal? It's the panther, yeah, the black panther there. Now, I'm not saying that this was what people typically did in the 70s, but it was a symbol of times which were changing. There's also the very important apparition in public of Caribbean culture, and in particular the carnival. The most famous of these is the Notting Hill Carnival, which was established in the early 60s and rapidly became a symbol of West Indian culture in London, and today is absolutely massive, of course. And today is very much integrated into the school curriculum and into the social life of the capital. But in the 60s, in the 70s, it was still very controversial, and there was often clashes with the police and so on. There's not just the Notting Hill Festival in London. You also get carnivals in other parts of the country. This is Leeds. And this is the sort of costume that you might be wanting to. And you can see that that people have taken months and months to make their own costume. You know, it's a big deal. I don't think I would look very good in one of these, actually. But you can see it's got a certain style to it, and it's absolutely huge. I was at this one. This is my photograph. I was at this one in Leeds, and there were 10,000 people dressed like this. It was absolutely massively strange. And here's Notting Hill. than in 2005, which these days is an absolutely enormous event with bigger and bigger speakers and a greater variety of music. At the beginning of the Notting Hill Carnival, the music was all steel pan. Steel band. It's a kind of music you make on an oil can, which has been adapted to make the different sounds, which is quite impressive. Because I'm sure if I gave you an oil can, we wouldn't get any nice music out of it. And it's very symbolic because it's an instrument that came out of poverty. That the oil cans were free, you could just find them, and then you made them into an instrument, which with an impressive amount of skill. So let me just tell you about two or three well-known cultural figures among the West Indian Britons. First of all, sculptor Ronald Moody. I don't know a lot about him, I must admit, but he's one of the British West Indian sculptors who has become relatively famous. I know a little more about this gentleman, C.L.R. James. And C.L.R. James is a rather strange mix because he was a radical left political activist and an expert in cricket. He was a journalist who wrote about cricket, and he was also a radical left organizer. It's un peu comme si Besançonot écrivait des livres sur le rugby, quoi. But that was him, and there he is writing. There he is. He's not around anymore, but he was one of the West Indians who became very much a public figure. So just a couple of sketches of West Indian Britons, which brings us on to the completely next question, which is key dates in the history of multiculturalism and diversity in the UK. And so I've chosen 15 key dates, which I'm going to tell you a little bit about, although there may be 16. So this is a little bit like the history of racism and anti-racism in the United Kingdom. So there's our first four, one of which I've already mentioned to you. Well, maybe two of which I've already rendered to, but I shall come to you. There's the first one then, 1936, Cable Street. Did I already talk about Cable Street? No? Oh, that's good. I'll talk about it now. 1948, Windrush. I mentioned that briefly. 1958, riots in Notting Hill. And 1962, Commonwealth Immigration Act. So let's start with those four. And here we have them one at a time. In 1936, now, of course, I'll just give you them so you can write them up first. So 1936, Cable Street. Now, of course, the 1930s, we all know a lot about. Well, we all know something about the rise of Hitler. 1933, Hitler became Chancellor of Germany, and this has been referred to by people who didn't like him very much as midnight in the century. 1933, midnight in the century. And now that we're looking back at it, that sounds a quite reasonable thing to say about the rise. But in fact, a Briton, of course, has been famous for being, under Winston Churchill, one of the victors against Hitler. However, in some ways, it could be said that we were rather lucky, because in Britain in the 1930s, you can see here a man in uniform and boots and his supporters doing a fascist salute. And this is in London. This is not in Italy. This is not in Germany. This is not in Czechoslovakia. I think that's the late today. Yeah, this is in London. And this was not a small movement. Oswald Mosley held meetings in big concert halls with many thousands of people. And so in some ways, I think we were kind of lucky. And one of the key dates is 1936, which is Cable Street. So what happened at Cable Street? Very simple story, really. Does anybody know what happened at Cable Street? Oh, well, I'll tell you. So Oswald Mosley, in a very classic fascist manner, said, "We're going to organise a march through the East End of London." The East End of London is the Jewish part of London. So it's a little bit like if Marine Le Pen said, we're going to organize a demonstration at Balbès Rochechouart in Paris, the absolutely Arab part of Paris. And so they decided they were going to march through the east end of London to show their power. And the march was tremendously important for the fascist organization, because fascist organizations are made up of people who really don't have a lot of interests in common. They're not all workers, they're not all businessmen, they're not all unemployed, they're not all anything. And so they're all very mixed organizations. And so the street demonstration is extremely important to make them feel stronger. And so what happened is that the local population, the local Jewish population, and the Communist Party and the trade unions said, no, we're going to stop them. And in fact, to cut a long story short, the fascists were unable to march because there were 100 or 200,000 people stopping them, and some fighting. And the result was a demoralization of the fascist organization for a very long period of time. And this has become a symbolic event, 1936, Cable Street. There are many, many songs about it. In the 1980s, I was in London, and we were knocking on people's doors, asking them not to vote for the fascists. And I met an old man who says, I was there at Cable Street. So that people still remember it today. And here you see a mural in London, a modern mural today, commemorating then what we call the Battle of Cable Street. And there's a detail from it. This has become even part of local history now, because there you have the Tower Hamlets Environmental Council, Environmental Trust, who have put up a commemorative plaque, the Battle of Cable Street. The people of East London rallied to Cable Street on the 4th of October 1936 and forced back the march of the fascist Oswald Mosley and his black shirts through the streets of the East End. You have to remember, this is the 1930s. Several thousand British workers went to Spain to fight with the Spanish Republic against Franco. This is a time when really, like, the ideas of fascism were very, very strong. And even though nobody had yet seen what the result would be, because people can't see the future. Yeah. But even so, you know, it was a very, very hot situation. Here is the photograph of the event itself. And as you can see, they could not pass. They couldn't get through. So this has become really, anybody in the Labour Party or on the left in Britain will know about Cable Street. This is one of those big moments. Similar to, you also have in France, of course, a 1936 event, which is tremendously important for the left, which is the Front Populaire. Of course, this is just one day, and the Front Populaire was a bigger thing. But 1936 was that kind of time. I already spoke to you a moment ago about Windrush, then, this symbolic day which represents the arrival then of what seemed at the time to be large numbers of West Indians. The numbers are not so big. It's just that before this, really, there were very few black people in Britain. In London, there were a few thousand black people in 1920, a few thousand in the whole of London. Yeah, so it was very different situation, and this is the first generation of worker immigrants, and you can see then here, as I was saying, the squares which are named after them. This is a square, a place, yeah, a place you can live, and there you can see the 65th anniversary national celebration of the arrival of the Windrushers as a representation of finding a new home and making it your home, which of course is always rather difficult. 10 years later is 1958 and the riots in Notting Hill. I was saying that when the West Indians arrived in London, they were surprised to find there was so much racism. And also remember, in the 1950s, racist discrimination was not illegal. Shops could have in their window a sign, no black people here, and this was legal, and people did it. It really existed. They weren't just imagining it. The very first legislation against racism is later in the 60s. So here you have a couple of pictures. First of all, at the top, You can see a slogan painted on a wall, no colour bar here. Yeah, no racial discrimination, no colour bar. The colour bar is like bar, prohibits. Yeah, and so no prohibition of coloured people. So you can see there were organisations. And over here, you have a demonstration. Black and white can live together in harmony, though. So a small demonstration, just a few people. Yeah, but this is 1958. What was special about 1958? It was because there was a lot of racism in London and indeed everywhere else. They had a particular problem with Teddy Boys, you know, the young music-orientated gangs who used to attack black people, and in particular mixed couples, because racists are always terrified by mixed couples. And what was different in 1958 was not the attacks, was that in 1958 in Notting Hill, and a part of London where a lot of people lived from Trinidad in particular, the young people organised to fight back against the Teddy Boys. That is, the older generation often didn't fight back, but the younger ones who'd been born in Britain or brought up in Britain, they weren't prepared to accept it. And so you had fighting on the streets of Notting Hill, and this changed the public debate, because suddenly all of the newspapers were talking about racism, whereas before, really, it didn't really interest anybody. So this became a big national debate. That's 1958, the Notting Hill riots. And one of the, there were two results. The government was very shocked by this fighting, this widespread and public fighting between young black men and young white racists. They were very worried about it. And they decided to react in two ways. I'm not saying whether they were right or they were wrong. First of all, as we shall see in a moment, they will try to reduce discrimination. And at the same time, they will try to reduce immigration. And so this is the very first act, the very first law to restrict the number of immigrants coming from the West Indies, India, Pakistan, and so on. And the full title was An Act to Make Temporary Provision for Controlling the Immigration into the United Kingdom of Commonwealth citizens, to authorise the deportation from the United Kingdom of certain Commonwealth citizens convicted of offences, etc., etc., etc. Two things about it then. First of all, notice that in the title it says temporary provision. So in theory, it was temporarily we are going to limit the number of immigrants. But in fact, it was not temporary. At the time, it was not temporary. And the second thing is, it has to be said that it was never really applied to immigrants from Canada, Australia. It was only applied to black immigrants and not to white immigrants. So the fact of the matter was it was only applied to some of the Commonwealth, what they called the new Commonwealth, India and Pakistan in particular, because there are a lot of people in India and Pakistan. Whereas if you were Australian, you never had any problem, or New Zealand or Canada, you never had any problem coming to Britain and staying. One of the things that makes Britain a little different from the point of view of immigration is the situation of the police. Because in England, if you're walking down the street, the police will not ask you for your identity. They're not allowed to do this, except if they have seen you commit a crime. Now this is very English, because this is what we like. So in Britain there is no identity card. People don't have an identity card, and it's interesting, because when I say to my British friends, I say in France everybody has an identity card, they say, "Oh, a fascist country." Okay. Yeah. So the English spirit is that it's impossible. The English attitude is, here is a policeman, he doesn't know who I am. Why is that my problem? If he wants to know who I am, he can ask me. I will tell him. So it's a kind of English anarchist sort of attitude. Okay, so that's the first time, but there will be many more. There will be several more laws in the 1970s to make it harder and harder for West Indians and Indians and Pakistanis and Africans to come to England. And today, it's very difficult. Today it's very difficult to, if you're not from Europe, the European Union, it's very difficult to get the right to become an immigrant. So if we move on to the 60s, we can see that the 60s and 70s, I've chosen three dates there to get us started. First of all, in 1965, the first Race Relations Act, which I'll be talking about the details of in a moment. But notice already the title of it, it's not the Anti-Racism Act. It's not the Preventing Racial Discrimination Act. It's the Race Relations Act. It's the idea that the problem is of two groups having good relations or not having good relations. So the word racism does not appear in this act, in fact, although it does actually make some discrimination illegal. The second is a very famous political speech by a leading member of the Conservative Party, Enoch Powell. In fact, such a famous speech that even today people know what it is. People have heard of this speech, even British people today. There are not many speeches that people can remember 50 years later. And finally, in 1977, I will be explaining a movement against the far right under the title of the Anti-Nazi League. So, first of all, the Race Relations Act. This act made it a civil offence to refuse to serve a person, to serve someone with unreasonable delay, or to overcharge, to charge a higher price, on the grounds of colour, race, or ethnic or national origins. What is the most disappointing word in this paragraph? What is the word that is really a pity? No, civil. Civil. That means you can't call the police. It's not a criminal offence. It's not a criminal offence. It's a civil offence. Yeah, which means that if a shop refuses to serve you, you can go to the magistrates and sue them. You have a porte plainte, but the police wouldn't. If you phone the police, they won't come. It's not a criminal offence. It's a civil offence. Yeah, so it's the smallest level. Yeah. But it certainly seems today to be very, very weak. On the other hand, to be fair, it was better than any other European country at the time. Because at the time, really, people didn't really care very much. Okay, so that made it a civil offence. So it was the beginning. And there was a very famous case of a racist Englishman who, just after this I remember this because I was only young, but I remember it. Just after this law was passed, he put in his garden a big sign: "My house is for sale to white people only." Yeah. And he did it because he was on television. All the television news was on it. You know what will happen to him, and so on. And it was a big public debate, and I have to say, sadly, many people agreed with him. Many people agreed with him that it was not a small minority. This was the 1960s. We always remember the music from the 1960s, which was great, but the racism was awful. It was really, 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 really awful. So the 1965 Race Relations Act. A few years later, 1968. Then there is this speech by a leading Conservative Party member, Enoch Powell. He was at the time a shadow minister, donc un porte-parole officiel sur j'ai oublié quel sujet. And he made a long speech which you can find if you want to read it. And he said, if black immigrants continue to come into Britain, our future is rivers of blood in the streets. Rivers of blood, the fleuve de sang. Yeah? And he was not a little minority stupid Nazi. He was a leading member of the Conservative Party. He lost his job after the speech. So he was, you know, he was not supported by the general Conservative Party leadership. However, when he lost his job, a whole group of dockers and immigration officers went on strike to support him. Yeah. So it was a big public debate. He had a lot of public support. I don't know about majority or not majority. I don't know, but he had a lot of public support. He was not a marginal voice. He was not a marginal voice. This is 1960. This is 1968. And in general, it's definitely the case that everyday racism has declined over the last 50 years. When I was at school, when I was 14, I could hear racist jokes every week. It was a normal thing to hear. Yeah, and this is not the case today. So, and here you have a picture of a graffiti, yeah? Powell for Prime Minister. Yeah, Powell for Prime Minister there. With this man walking with a wonderful hat. In the 1970s, the economy began to go worse again. It was the end of what you French fabulously call the Trente Glorieuses. Et la chose la plus importante de ne pas oublier des Trente Glorieuses, donc c'est 45-75 à peu près, la chose à ne pas oublier, c'est qu'après 29 ans des Trente Glorieuses, les gens n'étaient pas là à se dire, oh, bon, il reste qu'un an. Yeah. On the contrary, people really believed that mass unemployment was gone forever, that the world had completely changed and they would never again see mass unemployment. This was not the case, in case you didn't notice, this was not the case. Okay, so in this rise of mass unemployment again, then in the 1970s, of course, as always, there was some groups, some political groups, very keen to find out whose fault is it. And in the 1930s, it was the fault of the Jews, entre guillemets, in inverted commas. And in the 1970s, then it was racism against black people, which took the front stage. And in response, a group of left-wingers and trade unionists set up an organization, the Anti-Nazi League, because there had been a rise of the fascist organization, the National Front. And the National Front was beginning to get 25% in a local election here, 30% in a local election there. And so the Anti-Nazi League was set up, and the objective was to make it difficult for the National Front to build a powerful party. And they did this in two ways. First of all, every time the National Front had a meeting, there was always a demonstration in front. So a typical National Front meeting had 30 people in it, inside it, and 100 people outside protesting against it. So the idea was to tire them out. And the second thing was this, which is the very, very wide campaign with leaflets in every house in the country and badges of a million sorts against the Nazis. So here you have, you know, the most obscure badges against the Nazis, building workers against the Nazis, single parents against the Nazis, West Ham United, it's a football team, against the Nazis. There was even a pub somewhere that said, you know, people who drink at this pub against the Nazis. You know, it was a really sort of wild sort of popular movement. And here there has been a history written of it. This is the history that was written of it by Dave Renton, When We Touched the Sky, the Anti-Nazi League. And they even had some success attracting groups who were tempted by the far right, for example, skinheads. So here you have the symbol of the skinheads against the Nazis. This Anti-Nazi League organization was also linked to another campaign in the 1977, 78, 79, which you may have heard of, which was Rock Against Racism. Rock Against Racism had a different approach. And what they did is that they organized several hundred concerts around the country. And every time there was one black group, usually reggae, and one white group, usually punk. And they put them together. And this had an interesting effect because previously punk groups had sung to white audiences. Not necessarily racist audiences, but just white audiences. And reggae groups had sung to black audiences. And for the first time, you got the people into the same room. And it was really quite impressive. Very small groups, you know, very small local concerts. And it seems that they managed, among young people, to make for a few years, to make it so that racism was not cool. Which was quite an intelligent way of looking at political campaigning. They occasionally did enormous national carnivals. That's the Carnival Against the Nazis, with Tom Robinson, Steel Pulse. Steel Pulse is one of the most famous British reggae bands, and X-Ray Specs is one of the most famous British punk bands from the time. So this is a it's a kind of music. Never mind. Okay, this the Rock Against Racism carnivals. Okay, so that was the 1960s and the 1970s. Moving right on into the 1980s and the 1990s. You still don't remember anything. Oh, you maybe remember 2010. Yeah. So here we have a series of changes from the 1990s to 2010. Which really show that times have changed and new kinds of approaches. This is partly because, as the translation mentioned, the new generation of people whose parents were Indian or West Indians were not prepared to just say, okay, we'll accept it because we're new here, because they weren't new here. And so there was much more protest. And secondly, I think the left political parties began, after the 1970s, began to understand more about racism. In the 1970s, there were some very interesting moments. First of all, there was an important and a well-known strike at Imperial Typewriters, a factory on strike, and all of the strikers were black, and the trade union was not interested and would not support them. All of the trade union officials were white, and they would not support them. This is 74 or 72, early 1970s. And after that. After that strike, which was not successful, inside the trade union, some of the anti-racists said, hey, there's a problem here. Why did our trade union not support workers just because they're not white? And this became a big debate. And two or three years later, in 1978, there was another strike at Grunwick, a photo processing firm. And for the first time, all of the trade unions supported the black workers on strike. And after 1978, the trade unions begin to organise discussion days and debates and meetings and try to... And I'm not saying that trade unions understand everything about racism, not at all, but it was beginning to happen. So today, if you're organising an anti-racist concert and you phone the trade unions, they will automatically say, yes, we support you. Today, that's automatic. In the 1970s, they were really not interested at all. So that's been one important change. Now, here we have a series of events. Have you heard of Stephen Lawrence? Anybody? Yeah, okay. Okay, so Stephen Lawrence is a tremendously important figure in this. Perhaps you remember that in 2012, there was the Olympic Games in London. Yeah. And when they arrived at the Olympic Games, a woman was holding the torch, and it was Stephen Lawrence's mother. So it's become symbolically extremely important. Unfortunately, it's a tragic story for him to become an important thing. This is Stephen Lawrence. He was waiting at a bus stop in 1993, and a group of five white racists came and they killed him. It's a racist murder in 1993. Now, to be frank, in Britain, every few years there was a racist murder. There was a racist murder in 71. And normally it was in the newspapers for a few days and then it was forgotten. So what is special about Stephen Lawrence is not the fact that he was murdered. It is the fact that it wasn't forgotten, and it was a mass reaction. That for the first time, I think, a very large section of the population, white and black, were absolutely angry. Because the problem is, they didn't, everybody in the area knew who did it. They knew who did it. It was a group of racists who went around causing trouble, and people knew who did it. However, the police did not find proof. And the reason the police did not find proof is that really, they didn't care. That was the fundamental reason. That is that the police were not interested in finding proof. And this was shown, and this is what caused the scandal. This is what caused the scandal. And here you have the most incredible. So what happened is that nobody was arrested, or they were arrested and released because the police did not have proof. Okay? And a few months later, this is the Daily Mail. Now, the Daily Mail is a very conservative newspaper, not a left-wing newspaper at all. Not generally an anti-racist newspaper at all. On the contrary, it's like, c'est le Figaro, non même plus à droite, quand même. Really pretty, a bit like l'Express or something like that, yeah. And they put on the front page, these are the murderers. Now, perhaps you know a little bit about the law. It's very dangerous to write on the front page of your newspaper that somebody is a murderer. Yeah, if they take you to court and you lose, it can be like £20 million, you know, of damages, because they had not been arrested. And so this was a very, very, very symbolic, because even a conservative newspaper was joining a big campaign, Justice for Stephen Lawrence, which was something we'd never seen before. And in fact, there was a problem getting them arrested. So first of all, the police did not find the proof because they weren't looking. Secondly, the family brought a private prosecution. Alors ils ont organisé, on peut le faire en Angleterre, donc une accusation privée, un procès lancé par l'administration publique. And they lost. They were found innocent because there was not enough proof. And this was very problematic because, of course, you cannot be tried twice for the same reason. In any case, to cut a long story short, the Parliament passed a new law to say that it is sometimes possible to have two trials for the same crime when there is very new evidence. And 15 years later, some of them were put into prison. They got new evidence, DNA, yeah, etc. So most of them, not all of them, I think two of them are still free, and the other three are in prison. But really, the story was not just about Stephen Lawrence. When the new government, when the Conservative government was defeated in 1997, and the new Labour government under Tony Blair came in, one of the things they decided to do is they organised a public inquiry into the murder, and especially into the police. What were the police doing? Why were they not interested? And this is not an opinion that the police were not interested. This is the official government position. The government officially apologised because the police were not interested eventually. In any case, Lord Macpherson, Sir Macpherson, published the report into the inquiry, and it was a political explosion, a massive political explosion. This is not a small radical group. This is Sir Macpherson, appointed by the government to do an inquiry, and he said, the Metropolitan Police of London are institutionally racist. And that was absolute political explosion. Because like I say, it's not a little leaflet by the Communist Party saying the police are racist. This is the official, a lord appointed by the government said the police are institutionally racist. That is not some policemen are racist, but the police force is institutionally racist. So this was an absolute political explosion. And the result was a very long series of laws to do something against racism in Britain. Some of them were small. Some of them were small changes, like, for example, they made a special effort to recruit more black police. And some of them were very big changes. And the biggest one is no doubt this one, the Race Relations Amendment Act 2000. And I have to explain this a little bit. So a new law in 2000, and this new law took a new approach to racism and racist discrimination. It is an approach which they got some ideas from Australia, and some ideas from Canada, and some of them are new ideas from Britain. I'm sure that you know the two classic approaches. There are two classic approaches to racist discrimination. One is, like before this one, it's illegal to discriminate, but you have to prove the discrimination. Supposing, you know, you didn't get a job, and you think it's because you're a woman. But you have to prove it, and you know how difficult it is to prove discrimination. So this the first legal framework to fight against discrimination is the anti-discrimination laws, and they're good, but they're difficult because proving discrimination is tremendously hard, because you know they can always find a reason. A second possibility, which is not used in Britain but which is used in America, is a quota system. So, for example, in a university in Texas, they say, okay, there are 60% of black people in this town, so 15% of your professors must be black. And this is the law in parts of America, yeah, that this is a quota system. Yeah, and it's often criticised, but it has managed to stop a situation where you could have universities where all the students were black and all the professors were white. Yeah, so it's a very, very rigid situation. Now, in Britain, there are no quotas. In Britain, they introduced in 2000 a third possibility, which is a little bit more complicated, but which I'm going to explain to you. And this is that every public organisation, a hospital, a university, a local council, has a duty to promote racial equality. So this is they have an official duty to promote racial equality. It's not enough to avoid discrimination. They must promote racial equality. Let me give you an example of a hospital. It's an imaginary hospital, but it's a good hospital. Nobody's ill in it. And this hospital has 1,000 workers. And half of them are black. This is nothing surprising, but this is perfectly possible in London. 1,000 workers, 500 are black. And it has 100 managers, and 95 are white. Again, unfortunately, this is not so surprising. Under the new law, they must show that they are doing something about this problem. They have a lot of choice about what they can do, but they must show they're doing something. You have 50% black workers and only 5% black managers. You must do something. For example, every year, this imaginary hospital will have a special weekend for black workers who are interested in being managers. Special training, explain to them, encouragement. Or, for example, this is very, very typical, when you have a recruitment committee to employ a new manager, this hospital will say, all of our committees are half black and half white. And people say, well, that's impossible, you don't have enough black managers. Okay, we will invite to the committee black managers from Manchester, Liverpool, Glasgow, it doesn't matter how, but all of our committees will be half black and half white. Because it has been shown, unfortunately, recruitment committees always recruit people who resemble them. It's kind of automatic, you know, I always recruit people who resemble me. So these are a couple of examples, but in any case, every year, the hospital or university, etc., or bus system, must produce a report saying, this is what we are doing to encourage racial equality. Now, I don't know how well this works. I haven't had time to study how well it works, but I think it's an interesting idea. This is only the case in the public sector, not in the private sector, only public organisations. There is a campaign at the moment to extend this to the private sector, but also there is something else going on. In this hospital, for example, they want to buy a lot of beds. And they buy the beds from a private company, of course. And the trade union in the hospital goes to see the manager and said, we want you to buy the beds only from companies who have a good policy on racial equality. So in the public sector, the trade unions will try to push the management to encourage private companies who are taking this problem seriously. And quite often this will be successful because, you know, the managers, it doesn't cost much more to buy things for this company or that company. The unions will be happy. Hey, let's do it, let's do it. It's not a big deal quite often. So this is a long process which, like I say, still needs to be studied about promoting racial equality. And it's a little bit original. Like I say, the traditional methods were anti-discrimination laws or quotas, and this is a middle way which has interesting things. But as I say, I don't have a lot of information about the actual effect. The next big event, again, is legislative in 2003. In 2003, there were a new set of regulations, employment, equality, religion or belief. And this is an area in which certainly Britain is very different from France. I don't mind if you think it's wonderful or terrible. I don't mind at all. I just want to make sure you understand it. And the religion or belief regulations say that any employer must make reasonable adaptations for religious belief. So reasonable, what does that mean? Well, for example, if you work in this hospital and you want a room to pray, but you're a Muslim and you want a room to pray in, this is a big hospital. They have lots of rooms. They are obliged to say, yes, we will organise a prayer room for you. However, the same Muslim, if he works in a small shop with six employees, then the employer can say, well, it's not reasonable to organise a prayer room in a small thing. Same thing, supposing that for because of your religion, you don't want to work on a Saturday. If you're in a big supermarket and say, I don't want to work on a Saturday because it's my religion, I'm Jewish, I don't work on Saturdays, then the employer is obliged to say, okay, no problem. Except if it's a very small company where they have only three or four people and it will cause a big problem. So this is something very new. Like I say, I don't know the situation in other countries. I know, of course, in France, this would be very, very complicated because the religion is a big part of public debate in France and very controversial. And so that is the religion or belief. So you will see people working in supermarkets and when they're organising, they say, okay, we're organising next week. You work in the alcohol section next week. And you can say, no, sorry, I don't work in the alcohol section because of my religion. So I'll think of somebody else, yeah? I'll organise it. So this is something interesting. And like I say, I'm aware of that this can be controversial. And certainly, you know, if you have to write about it in the exam, I don't care if you agree, if you think it's good or bad. I don't care at all. That's fine. You write whatever you like. Just if you show you understand it, that's okay. That's the fine. Some of my j'ai dit laïcar parmi mes meilleurs amis. Okay. Final one then for today is the final law for today is the Equality Act 2010, which consolidated and united all the different laws into one. Now, of course, I don't want to exaggerate. You can sometimes have very nice laws which are not really applied. So, you know, it's not always so easy to do. Okay, what else do I have here? Oh, I have a couple of definitions of multiculturalism. A couple of definitions of multiculturalism from. I will put the PowerPoint onto the blog as well, so you can see it. Yeah, and if I don't, send me an email to remind me. Okay. What is multiculturalism? This is from John Rex, who's a university professor. Multiculturalism in the modern world involves, on the one hand, the acceptance of a single culture and a single set of individual rights governing the public domain, and a variety of folk cultures in the private, domestic, and communal domains. Okay, so that's one fairly useful definition, but not so easy, because it's very difficult to know. You say multiculturalism, it's a nice word, but it's very difficult to know. You say, okay, so what is your culture? You know, what is your culture? Well, I like pizza. I like African music. I like to dress with in South American clothes. This is the world, you know, the modern world is very, very varied. And it can be difficult to know, you know, what is your, I don't know, what is my culture, you know. I was brought up a Catholic in England. I'm married to a French woman whose father was German and whose mother was Italian. What's my culture? I don't know. You know, it can be not so easy to define, you know, what your culture is. So, but that's what's one idea. These are not definitions to learn. These are definitions to help you think about the problem of defining multiculturalism. So that's the first one. Multiculturalism involves, on the one hand, the acceptance of a single culture and a single set of individual rights governed in the public domain and a variety of folk cultures in the private, domestic and communal domains. And here's another one. Somebody who's not so happy with the idea. The idea of a plural or multicultural society is a deeply ambiguous one. The concept of multiculturalism overestimates the homogeneity and the autonomy of the various ethnic groups and underestimates the degree to which all groups are reciprocally implicated in the creation of cultural forms within a common framework. That looks very complicated. It's not. If you walk out into Rouen and you find one Muslim, one Jew, and one Catholic, and you say, "What's really important for you in the culture?" All three of them will say Game of Thrones. Yeah. I mean, of course, I'm exaggerating, but it's not so easy to separate cultures out when, in fact, what is really important is Facebook and Game of Thrones. You know. Maybe you also have religious culture, but it might not make very much difference to you. And finally, then, just a couple of things going on at the moment, sort of this last couple of years. There are many different reactions to multiculturalism. Many, many different groups are trying to think of things they could do to encourage racial equality. So here is an example. The rise of the Black Pound. This is an event. It's a day. You pay to go there. It's non-expensive. £5, really not expensive to go to a meeting. And this is about empowering black businesses and individuals. Basically, this is a thing. They are saying to black people, you should buy in black shops. This is how we can help the community. Yeah, that black people should support black businesses, and that's the way forward. So this is one possible reaction to the situation. Here's another one. As we know, you can have anti-racist education at universities, but the worst racism you see at football grounds. And this is an organisation where called Show Racism Red Card. And what they do is they go to football grounds every week with leaflets and information and little videos and talk to people about racism at football grounds, which is, I would think, probably even more important than in universities, yeah? And they're pretty good. Show Racism, the Red Card, they're a pretty good bunch. And they've they persuaded a bunch of footballers. This is a football team, and they're all carrying Show Racism, the Red Card. So they managed to get them all together there. And the final one, the latest incarnation of Rock Against Racism, which is Love Music Hate Racism, and this is their concert from 2015. All proceeds going to support refugees in Kelly. That's all we have time for today, and that's the end of that story. But I will be bringing you some listening to do next week. Thank you for listening.